catch up with people. If you're new here, my name is Alex. I'm the pastor of Cascades. We're glad that you're here. And we're in the book of Acts today, Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27. Let me give you a little bit of information about this book. Acts chapter 27 describes the voyage and shipwreck of Paul and nearly 300 others as they head to Rome. Acts chapter 27 is a very, very long chapter. It's very detailed. It's very detailed. In fact, it's actually led one guy to ask, why on earth would Luke devote so much of his precious space to this graphic but seemingly unedifying story? It's very long. It's 44 verses long. We're not going to read it all. Some of you rejoice at that. Okay, I know that. We're not going to read it all today, but we will go through it. I think one of the reasons why this chapter is actually so important is because it's actually the climax of Acts, of the whole book of Acts. It's the climax of it. Just as in the Gospel of Luke, the trial and crucifixion of Jesus are the climax of that gospel, this voyage and shipwreck serve as the climaxes of the book of Acts. Both of these books, the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, are written by the same author, Luke. And this is intentional, this climax that we see here. The cross in the Gospel of Luke served as the moment when the powers of darkness did their worst to Jesus. And what we're going to see here is that this voyage and shipwreck is the moment when the powers of darkness seek to do their worst to Paul. But as we've seen in the gospel, in the cross, and in the resurrection of Jesus, God overcomes. God overcomes. So let me pray for us, and then we'll go through this chapter. Blessed you are, Lord, great God. Blessed you are, eternal God, in times past and today. You have spoken in the past, and your people have been guided through all kinds of wildernesses, supported in all kinds of storms and tribulations. Speak to us today. In the midst of our own confusions, speak to us through your gospel. Transform us by your grace. Renew us in hope. For yours is the future even more than the past. Amen. This morning, our big idea is that opposition will not thwart God's mission. And what we're going to do here is look at the three parts of this, the voyage, the storm, and the shipwreck. So let's look at the voyage. We can start in verse 1. When it was decided that we would set sail to Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. So we'll just stop right there. What we see here is Paul, a bunch of other prisoners, and this guy Julius, he's a centurion. The centurion's going to be guarding all these prisoners. But what you need to pay attention to right here is that it says we. And the reason it says we is because Luke was actually present for part of this. And so was this other guy, one of Luke and Paul's friends, Aristarchus. And those three were going on this ship heading to Rome. This is one of the reasons why it's also so detailed, is because Luke was there for it, so he's going to tell you everything. Some of the other parts he wasn't present for, so he's summarizing. But this was the goal, was to get to Rome. And can you imagine Paul's feelings at this point? For the past 2 years, he's been in prison, in Caesarea, waiting, with no hope of real justice really happening. The justice system wasn't transparent there, and that was one of the reasons he had laid claims, saying, hey, I'm a Roman citizen, I want my trial, this to stand before Caesar, I have that right, because it's not going to happen here. And that's finally happening, after 2 years of seeing really nothing move. Can you imagine how encouraged he must have been? He's like, finally, something's happening. We're seeing some progress here. He must have felt so excited. It's kind of like that feeling when, you know, when you finally start moving, when you're stuck on the highway, you just feel so good. You're like, oh my gosh. Well, sure enough, he starts moving, but pretty soon we're going to see things start to slow down again. In this moment, though, there's this excitement. And I'm going to show you just a map of the route they were taking. The best way to get there was by boat. But you got to remember, we had no engines, right? No motorboats. So you're sailing. You're at the mercy of the winds and the waves. And so there was no direct route. There wasn't a ferry. There was none of that. They were going to have to find their way there by hopping on different ships. And so the first ship they get on is one that takes them from Caesarea to Sidon. And then from there, pretty much right after Sidon, they actually start getting some trouble. into some troubles, and the trouble they face is winds. The winds start actually blowing them north of that island, Cyprus, you can see there. They probably would have preferred to go south of it, but the winds blow them far north, and then they end up having to go there. And they keep kind of traveling along the coast there of modern-day Turkey, and they get to this place called Myra. And in Myra, that was the end of that first ship that they were on. It was a merchant ship stopping at these different ports, and that was the end of where he was going to get. And so they get off there, and Julius has to find another ship so that they can eventually get to Rome. And so Julius finds one that's going to Rome. It's an Alexandrian ship. And all these prisoners that also have to face Caesar are put on the boat, on the ship, and they leave. But as soon as they leave Myra, they face even more troubles. More winds continue to blow them farther north, blowing them off course. It actually pushes them. If you look at where it says Fair Havens, right above it is Crete. That whole little section, that island, is Crete. And the winds blow them up there into that area. They actually wanted to come below these tiny islands. And they're forced to go up there. Eventually, they do manage to make it down to Fair Havens on this island, Crete. It's this little fishing town, but it's taken them a lot longer than they planned. By the time they get to Fair Havens, it's already well into October. Now, at this time, sailing the Mediterranean was generally viewed as dangerous if you were in the middle of October, and pretty much impossible from November to February or March. And when they got to Fair Havens, Luke tells us in verses 9 to 12, much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. And this year, when this happened, it probably would have been right around, the Day of Atonement would have been October 5th. So already you're in the bad season for sailing. So Paul warned them, men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship, since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in. The majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete, facing both the southwest and the northwest. If you go back to the map for just a second, you can see where Phoenix was. It was really close to them. That was one of the ideas they had. Okay, so Paul warns Julius, he warns the pilot, the ship owners, and guys, this is bad news. We shouldn't do this. This is the wrong time of the year to do this. This wasn't him having some kind of divine warning from God saying it. This actually was coming from experience, because Paul was an experienced sailor. He had gone by this point on 11 voyages. He would have traveled 2,500 miles by sea. Three times he would have been shipwrecked. This was him speaking from experience. He knew what he was talking about, and he knew the Mediterranean well. But the problem was, for all the other guys that were trying to weigh this out, was that Fair Havens wasn't a very safe port. It didn't really do well in the winter. So keeping their boat there meant that they risked actually having their ship destroyed. And that was the tension they were caught in. On top of that, there was a financial incentive, because Caesar at this time wanted the ships to be coming to Rome year-round, even in the winter, even when it was dangerous, because they needed food, they needed grain. And there was this incentive for anyone who would sail during this time, they'd make more money. So there was this tension at work here, but Paul saw the risks, and he didn't think it was worth it. In the end, the others and Julius choose to listen to one another instead of Paul. Maybe that's been you in your own life, at work, at home, with your friends or your family. You've been down a path, you start to see its trouble, and actually you tell the rest of the group, guys, it's not a good idea. We should not take this route. This is not going to end well. But the group goes in a different direction. How do you respond in that moment? See, even though Paul sees it as a bad idea, he still goes along with them. He thinks that people may even die, that they'll probably be shipwrecked and lose materials. And Paul goes with them, and when the company that you're with or the church or the city is making what you feel isn't the best decision, do you still believe that God is in control in that moment? Maybe you go ahead with it, but you're unhappy, you're angry, or you throw a pity party, you start grumbling. Well, in this case, what happens is Paul, you could argue he kind of has to, he's a prisoner. But we don't see that he fights them on this. He doesn't cause a big ruckus for it. And when these winds start blowing south, these guys actually, Julius and all the others, they see an opportunity. They see an opportunity to actually go, to leave this port of Fair Havens. They know the time is tight, so they're like, look, this is a chance. So they go. And things at first seem good. And they start sailing and moving on. And you can see how far Rome is up there. It's a long ways, and they want to get there quickly before weather gets even worse. But what happens when things start to go wrong? That's what happens here. Because they never actually make it to Phoenix. They come to the storm. They face the storm. And let's look at what this storm, part two, what God is doing and what Paul does. Soon, as they set out, they actually encounter these hurricane-force winds. That's called the Northeaster. And it pushes them, and the ship actually gets caught in this storm, and they basically get pushed farther and farther off course. Winds get so strong that they actually start taking the lifeboat, which would have been on the side of the ship. They got to put it on the top of the ship. I don't know enough about ships, but you get the picture. They tie it to try to stabilize it. And the winds continuously just push them farther and farther. They throw anchors over to try to temper the effects of the ship being tossed and turned by the winds and the waves. They actually start throwing cargo off of their ship because it gets so bad. Stuff that they had intentions of selling, now they're actually having to get rid of. So you can imagine their feelings at this point. The storm is bad. This is not what they had hoped for. They knew this was this risk, and now they're actually facing the risk. And you can imagine the fear they would have felt at the potential of dying. Maybe regret that they're actually losing all this product they hoped to sell. Angry that they didn't stay back in Fair Havens. At least there, the ship would have been maybe destroyed, but they could have survived. Here now, their lives are in danger. In August of 2015, a storm hit our city. And at that time, they called it one of the worst storms in a decade. You know where I was? I was at home. The comfort of my home. I was reading about it, though, online, watching videos about it, and the storm was the storm that was bad. It was the one that actually shut down the Moan Highway. Trees were falling on the highway. Trees were falling on streets, branches on cars. People were actually hit by trees. Power at one point knocked out power for over 400,000 people in our city. This was a bad storm in 2015. So I was at home. I remember traffic was a nightmare. And the reason why I cared about traffic that day was because my wife, Lindsay, she was stuck on a boat caught in the Howe Sound. She had been serving up at Anvil Island as a cabin leader. And she was coming home, and she was on that big boat, the one that brings all the campers back, heading home. And she called me, telling me how the boat was rocking like crazy, swinging back and forth, how no one was allowed to actually go on the top deck. Everyone had to stay below. Everyone had to stay safe, and yet there was this fear as they were traveling through the Howe Sound that day. This boat, she said, she talked about how it just swung back and forth, and there was this feeling of helplessness that people had. They couldn't control the weather. They had this fear that day, and she was asking, hey, could you pray for us? Could you pray for my co-cabin leader who's really anxious about what's happening right now? And I remember praying that day, and that storm was bad for our city. That sailing of that boat that eventually did make it to the mainland, that ended up being the last sailing that day. No other ships were allowed to set sail because of how bad the weather was. Now, that storm just lasted really a day. But the storm we're reading about today lasted days, over a week. It was so strong that it was dark. You wouldn't see the sun, you wouldn't see the stars at night. And so that fear that people had, the anger that people had, initially actually started to turn into something else. It started to turn into this sense of hopelessness, hopelessness was this emotion that was starting to overcome them as they sat and worked and were stuck on this boat. And you can see that because Luke tells us in verse 20, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up hope of being saved. Luke here is careful to note that they're in darkness, that in the darkness they gave up hope. No sun, no stars for days. The darkness wasn't just around them, though. The darkness was starting to envelop them, and they gave up hope of being saved. That storm just kept going. And, you know, when you think about this hopelessness, it's kind of debilitating when you live in it, because you feel powerless, so you don't have any motivation. You feel dejected. You don't have this fight in you. When you have hope, you fight. You refuse to give up because you know the things that you hope for that are currently unseen will become reality. But they didn't have that in this moment. They're despairing. Luke doesn't say, oh, the exception here is Paul, or the exception is here is me. He says we all gave up hope that we would be saved. Now, there's something here that we need to understand about the sea, because we don't look at the sea in this way. When we go to the sea, we're like, man, I love the sea. I love to hang out on it, to swim in it. But Jews didn't look at it like that. Jews looked at the sea differently. It was not a place they particularly liked. It was a symbol of darkness and chaos, a source of danger and untamable power. N.T. Wright notes, the sea represented the dark forces of chaos which had been overcome by God's good creation. Think back to Genesis 1, how the Spirit of God hovered over the seas and it was all dark. But God, his good creation, he overcomes the chaos. The sea also represented the equally dark force that had threatened the children of Israel before the Dead Sea and opened up to let them through. So the sea was a symbol of chaos, a source of danger and untamable power. In the book of Daniel, which was very popular at this time, was an apocalyptic book, and it wrote and it described how these sea monsters would come out of the water, the sea, and attack God's people and what he was seeking to do. So Jews treated the sea warily. They didn't trust it because they knew that they couldn't control it. And if you think about it, we don't like not having control either. We hate not having control. And when we realize we don't have control, we withdraw, we get angry, we pout, we demand to get our way. Think about it when you get stuck on the highway. What's the first thing you start doing? What the? Hey, check Google Maps. What's going on here? What's the next best route to take? I need to get off the highway. Or you check AM 730 radio, right? What about when we face unemployment? Or when you face cancer or an illness, or when your internet is so slow but your Wi-Fi bars are full, and you're like, what is going on? So there's this frustration. And part of that frustration comes out of this shock, I think, that we have in those moments where we are reminded we actually don't have as much control as we think we do. The sea serves as that. But those moments I've just described serve that like that in the same way. They remind us we actually don't have control. And sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking we do. And it comes as to us as a shock in those moments. So what do you do with that? This storm here in this moment has led Paul, Luke, and 300 others to realize they have no control whatsoever over the storm, and they believe they're going to be swallowed up into it. What would you do? What do you do in a moment like that? Well, I was asking that question this week, and I started to think maybe that's the wrong question to ask. That rather than asking, what do I do in that, maybe I need to be asking, what has God done? What does he do? If you look at verses 21 and 25, we see what God does for Paul. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. Kind of sounds like Paul here is rubbing it in a little bit, right? Putting salt in the wound. Come on, man, that's not very pastoral. That's not very friendly. But he goes on, but now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Why? How can he know that? Because last night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will be just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island." This is huge. This is a huge moment in this story that we're seeing, in this climactic point in Luke's story of the book of Acts. Because in the darkness, in the storm, when Paul and all the others have no control and have given up, look what God is doing. Think back to the Gospel of Luke or the other Gospels. In that moment of darkness, it looks like there's just despair. Good Friday, Jesus has breathed his last. And this movement of God looks like it's been snuffed out. The religious leaders, the political leaders that schemed against God's work, the enemy who had been working behind their heart, it looks like they've been victorious. And in this case, it looks like these natural forces are snuffing out this movement of God once again. But God is interjecting. He's saying, "No, you're not alone. I haven't abandoned you. I am here with you." And if you think back to this, this story in Acts and what God has been doing in the person of Paul, you know that Paul, after having a fantastic ministry in Ephesus, spending time discipling, mentoring, developing leaders there for 2 years, starts to see these amazing miracles. And after these amazing miracles of people giving up practicing magic, worshiping Artemis, and start worshiping Jesus and his way, he says, "I want to go to Rome." You see that in Acts chapter 19, verse 21. That was about 3 years before this point that we're in right now. He says, "I must go on to Rome." But 1 year later, Paul was imprisoned in Jerusalem, not Rome. And there, when wondering, am I ever going to make it there? Am I even going to survive here in Jerusalem? Jesus comes and visits him and says, "Be encouraged, Paul. Just as you have been a witness to me here in Jerusalem, you must preach the good news in Rome as well." Well, Paul must have forgotten that because he was despairing with all the others, wondering, is this it for us? Are we swallowed up in the sea? But God sends his angel, this messenger, to say, "Hey, it's not hopeless. There is hope. Don't be afraid. I'm with you, and you need to stand before Caesar. And everyone with you will be saved. You're going to lose the ship, but everyone with you will be saved." In the chaos, the darkness of the untamable seas, none of that would stop God's plan. The powers of darkness would not thwart God's mission. God reminds Paul that he's in control, that just as we saw in the Gospels, that God overcomes the schemes of man, the schemes of the enemy, all of the evil he undoes it in the resurrection of Jesus. We're seeing that God is faithful now to his mission, to his plan. Maybe you're wondering, though, so what is his plan? What is his mission? Well, Paul actually tells us in Ephesians chapter 1, in Ephesians chapter 1, Paul writes, "God has now revealed to us his mysterious will regarding Christ, which is to fulfill his own good plan." And this is the plan. At the right time, he will bring everything together under the authority of Christ, everything in heaven and on earth. Everything in heaven and on earth will come under the authority of Christ. Life and death under his authority. Light and darkness. Land and sea, everything, natural, supernatural. He is king and lord over all, not Caesar. And he is bringing his rule to earth, his reign, his kingdom. He's bringing it here. And in his rule, he brings justice, not injustice. He brings goodness, not evil. He brings life, not death. And all of the evil that's been done, he begins to undo. And he started it with his own unjust death. This is what he's doing. And he's not just doing it with his own life. He's actually bringing it and starting it with humanity, those who were supposed to actually represent him to this world. So what does Scripture tell us then about, if we know his plan, what does it tell us about his character and about how God works? Well, in Proverbs 21, it says, no human wisdom or understanding or plan can stand against the Lord. In Isaiah 54, it says, but in that coming day, no weapon turned against you will succeed. These benefits are enjoyed by the servants of the Lord. Their vindication will come from me. I, the Lord, have spoken. You think back to the picture of Jesus, this is exactly what God does in his son. He vindicates him. All of the false accusations put against him are shown to be untrue, and he's shown to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the firstborn among the dead and resurrected. Romans 8:28 says this. It says, we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. For God knew his people in advance, and he chose them to become like his son. See, his plan is to bring his rule and reign here. And part of that means that for each one of us, we're called to actually reflect a life that looks like his son, Jesus, in all of his goodness, his love, his mercy. We actually reflect that. We bring that. So that even in the storm, when we don't have control, when we're caught in these seas, we're actually people who hope, who live out a hope that's rooted in what he has already done and what he will do when he returns. So that even in the storm, we actually look like Jesus. When this penetrates your heart, when you've made these scriptures, God's promises yours, when you cherish God's word and it's hidden in your heart, you become one who actually lives with this hope and purpose in the midst of your own storms. Let's look at how Paul responds to what God has done. Paul calls the people on the ship to keep courage. He says, keep courage twice at the beginning and the end of what he's saying. He says, keep courage, keep up your courage. Don't give up. Don't let fear take over. We're going to make it through this. We're going to have to run the ship aground, but we're going to be okay. From this point on, having heard this message from God, having been spurred on in hope, now he's calling everyone else to have hope, to keep their courage. And his goal is to actually help everyone else survive. But if you notice and you read on, you're going to see that not everyone has the same hope. Because the second thing he calls them to is to actually stay together. After almost 2 weeks at sea, the sailors sensed that they were getting really close to land, but they didn't really look at that as a good thing because it was dark and they couldn't really see much. And they were afraid they'd get dashed on the rocks. So they dropped their anchors and basically just prayed for daylight. And this was a normal thing. When you couldn't see much, they're just like, all right, let's just set up camp right here and hope we make it. Hope we get some daylight and we can figure out where we are. Not everyone had the hope Paul had, though, and we know that because these sailors secretly wanted to escape with that lifeboat they had plopped up on the top of their ship. They're up a deck, and Paul realized this, and he knew that without the sailors, they would die. They're the experts. They were the ones that were doing all of this, ensuring that the prisoners and the soldiers and everyone else there make it. If they left, there was no chance ever anyone else would survive. So in verse 31, we see, then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. And you can imagine how angry those sailors were at Paul, hey? Paul's probably thinking, man, I'm so glad the centurion's here. I'm a dead man otherwise. These sailors are like, just wait till we get on the mainland. You're not making it to Rome, right? This is what's going on here. But there's something else happening too. They haven't been eating. So Paul calls them to eat food. Super basic, right? It's like, duh, come on. But that's what he does. Just before dawn, Paul urged them to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you've been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all, and then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. What I find fascinating here is this whole sequence of events. All the sailors are mad, and Paul's like, hey guys, you need to eat. You guys need to eat some food, eat some bread. And no one listens to him. No one's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. If anything, they just stand there. So Paul just keeps going. He's like, okay, takes some bread, gives thanks for it in front of them. And can you imagine at this point, these guys are probably like, this guy needs to shut up. I'm tired of him talking, interfering with our plans. He needs to be quiet and just stay there. He's a prisoner. And yet here he is calling them to eat. I think if you think through what's going on here, it's been dark for so long. They haven't received the message. They're anxious. They're hopeless, some of them. Some of them are angry. They're probably also hangry, and this is why Paul's calling them out. You're not eating? Man, I skip one meal, I'm hangry. Okay, I get irritable. I also get a little bit more focused. Sometimes I skip meals at lunch because I'm just really focused on what I'm trying to do. And then I come home. And like immediately, Lindsay knows something's going on when I get home because she'll say to me, what's going on? What's wrong with you right now? Did you skip lunch? And all of a sudden, I'm like, I got really focused. And it interrupts my hanger. I start acting differently. Simple little things bother me. And that's one meal. But can you imagine what it must be for these guys who haven't eaten for days in their anxiety, in their suspense? And here Paul is saying, guys, eat. And it's hilarious to me because, you know, it's kind of like, I was thinking, when I'm hangry, I'm kind of like the Hulk, but without the strength. I'm just green and angry and irritable. And I can't listen to anyone's advice. And that's what it sounds like these guys are like. You know, someone will say, hey, you're really angry, and you should probably just go for a walk. Maybe just take a deep breath. And in your anger, you're like, you need to go for a walk. You need to calm down. You need to believe. And you can't receive what they're telling you because you're so defensive. It's almost like your brain can't process it. Your brain's not working properly. That's where these guys are at. Paul tells them, guys, you need to eat. You need to survive. Not one of you are going to lose a hair. They don't do anything. They just stand there. Paul gives thanks, praise in front of them, and then starts eating. But you notice none of them ate with him. It says, he broke it, began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food. It's almost like they saw him, oh, you know what? That looks really good. Man, I haven't eaten for a while. Maybe I should eat some bread. And so they do. And that changes them. Their disposition changes in that moment. They have just enough to keep going. What I find interesting here is that Paul had this hope and no one else really did. And he's able to eat with hope and give thanks to God in this moment, in the storm where no one else really is having that hope. And they needed to actually see Paul's hope practice by eating, such a basic act. And in seeing him eat, they're actually able to see that hope he has, and they're able to do the same. They're like, yeah, I want that. See, God encouraged Paul, and Paul was able to encourage others through that. Let's look at the shipwrecked. Verse 39 tells us, when daylight came, and they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. So they started at this point taking all the steps necessary to try to run aground. You know, they're dropping anchors. They had thrown food off already. They untied ropes for the rudders. But then the ship hit a sandbar. And you can hear in your mind the horrible grind and crunch that the boat would have made as it lurched in that sandbar. Not just that, but the hull would have broke open and water would have been rushing in. You can hear sailors, prisoners, soldiers screaming as their boat is just taking on more and more water. And while the boat has stopped, the wind and the waves haven't. And so they're just being beat with these wind and waves over and over again. This is when things start to take a dark turn. Because the soldiers realize what will likely happen if these prisoners escape. See, if the prisoners escape, the punishment that they were due to receive actually falls on them, the soldiers. Well, no soldier wants to take a punishment they didn't take on, so what's their plan? Let's kill them. We read in verse 42, the soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But here is where God is always at work, always going before us. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. And he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to the land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. And in this way, everyone reached land safely. Now you got to admit, that's a pretty long, detailed story, especially if you actually read it all through. But Luke wants you to see something in doing that. That in the darkness, that in the storms in the sea, where the dark forces can be at work, God is still at work, and he overcomes them. He did it in Christ. He does it in his people. He doesn't abandon them. Even in these minute little details that we find like kind of unedifying, God is at work here. That he's sovereign. His mission will not be thwarted. His plan to bring everything in heaven and on earth under his authority, to make everything right again, will not be thwarted. His heart to renew and restore what he created and declared good, it will actually come to reality. He started this in his Son, in his life, death, and resurrection. You see Jesus overcome sin, Satan's schemes, humanity's schemes. You see Jesus overcome death by rising 3 days later. The natural, the supernatural, the human and the spiritual. He is Lord over all and nothing will thwart him. Paul gets caught in this uncontrollable storm where it seems like the forces of darkness will prevail, threatening to undo the work of God that he wants to do in Rome. And we get caught in these uncontrollable storms too, and we face the powers of darkness, and it threatens to undo the work that God wants to do in our city, in our church, in our families, and in our own lives. But he's faithful, and he doesn't abandon those who love him. He vindicates them. He is faithful. Well, I want to speak to those who hear that, and they actually think of things like what happened yesterday in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio. Senseless evil that is tragic. That when you see that, you're like, how can God allow that if he's sovereign and good? How can he be so patient in the face of evil? How can he tolerate that? How can he tolerate that? But even just the accidental, tragic deaths amongst all the other evil. I was thinking about this week as I was thinking through this passage, that tension that we live in. And, you know, to try to provide an apologetic answer for something that's actually a lived experience isn't really helpful for people. Pastorally, how do you walk alongside someone who's facing this death and suffering? And to be honest with you, I don't really think there are words sometimes. But I would say that we worship a God who understands it, who has faced evil. He came face to face with the forces of evil, who came face to face with death, who saw the schemes of men and could say to them, Father, forgive them. We worship a God who is well acquainted with suffering and affliction, with evil in this world. But we don't worship a God who was overcome by it. We see one who overcomes all of it. That our God is one who overcomes it. And so his kingdom has come already, but it's not here in its fullness. And we live in this tension of that. We live in this tension of it. So how can we worship him? Well, we worship him because we know that he's a God that actually understands our very weakness, who was tempted in every way but did not sin, who loves us, who cares for us, who doesn't abandon us in the darkness, but empowers us and enables us to overcome, even when it looks like nothing would enable us to do it. This is what he does for those who love him. You see, he's the Lord, not Caesar in Rome. And that's what Paul's going to declare. But it's what you and I get to declare every day of our lives, is that he is the king, that we trust him, and he's going to return. And we place our hope that there will be a day where he actually undoes all of the evil that we experience and see and hear about. And that's part of what we declare in communion. And so I'm going to invite Ian to come up to facilitate and lead us in that.